Hello, welcome to Time to Say Goodbye. It is the 27th of March. Tyler is back after many travels, and we have a show today. It's just the two of us. We're going to talk about a couple things, sort of a catch-up episode, I think, more than anything. But Tyler, how are you doing?
Good, man. Doing fine. I've been traveling a lot. I was down in Florida visiting family and juggling work stuff alongside that. And then we arrived back just in time for a terrible ice storm that knocked out power to most of southern Maine. And so we were using a generator, and then I had to go down to Rutgers to give a talk. So I've just been kind of all over. Jersey was New Jersey. They let you take beer out of hotel bars now. So I watched the Iowa basketball game last night and took some hotel beers to go and sat in my room and was antisocial. It was great.
What does that mean?
Bars have made to go alcohol legal. And so you can just, show up and ask for to go booze and leave with it, which is excellent. So
yeah. Do you feel like we're in this period of intense legalization everywhere? I guess I'm just thinking about in terms of marijuana and sports gambling, where we're veering towards a more permissive society. I don't know. Totally. I've been thinking about that a lot. I actually am writing something about it. I don't want to give away too much about it, but it's made me think recently about whether, and I feel old as hell saying this type of stuff, but I do think it is relevant for people on the left, right, to think about, which is that we tend to have almost libertarian politics around some of this stuff as long as it relates to like some taboo that we disagree with. And the strangest part about it is that like a lot of this stuff that is legalized could be done in a way that would benefit some sort of like general leftist program, right? Like, I'm not even talking about ideological. You just say like you can fund some state-run thing that can benefit a lot of people. But it's almost like there's this thing where it's like once it's passed and once the thing is legal, everyone just forgets about it. Like you don't think about it anymore. And all sorts of problems can arise, but you're not allowed to complain about the problems that arise, right? Gia Tolentino in The New Yorker wrote this piece about the disaster of legal weed rollout in New York State, right?
Specifically
in New York City. And it's not, I haven't been back to New York in a while. And so I didn't even know. Apparently there's like a weed shop on every corner in New York now.
I noticed that when I was back. Yeah, man.
Those are like all not really supposed to be there, all unregulated. Like the idea generally was that, you would have a few regulated stores and then you would have, and that those would actually be beneficial to people who had been incarcerated before on marijuana charges, like as a form of restitution. And like none of that happened just because, they opened the floodgates and people just opened their own shops and like they're not enforcing anything. So I don't know. It's a strange balance, I think. I generally think it's bad when people on the left, right, who argue for economic redistribution, etc., turn into libertarians about very specific things.
The beer thing in Jersey was weird, man. I mean, I wasn't complaining about it, but so I Googled it. I had a few beers at the bar watching the first half of the Iowa game, and the guy, I was cashing out, and he's like, "Do you want any beer to go?" And I was like, "What?" And he was like, "Yeah." He's like, "We sell beer to go." And I was like, "I mean, yeah, that sounds good, but like, I don't know if that should be legal." And I Googled it, and apparently they legalized it this past July. And I feel like that there are negative externalities, like letting bars let people take, booze to go. I mean, you can get hard alcohol to go. I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, I was like a crass opportunist and took advantage of it, but in a, broader societal impact way, I don't know.
I guess there's an argument to be made about like equitable outcomes there that I think I would be somewhat amenable to hearing because, for example, in San Francisco, 10 years ago when I lived there, actually longer than that, 15 years ago when I lived, actually even longer than that, in the late 2000s or the late aughts, right? I lived in San Francisco and I lived near Dolores Park, which is a very famous park in San Francisco in the Mission District. And back then, I think probably still now, but maybe a different crowd, you would have a whole bunch of kind of white hipstery people hanging out in the park day drinking, open containers at all times of the day, right? And there was an argument made that, this was pretty shitty given that people would be busted for that in different neighborhoods, right? And like in black neighborhoods, open container stuff, people would get buzzed for that. And the cops just turned a complete blind eye because it was a bunch of, you know, white techie hipstery people who were pretty rich, because the Mission at that point had already gotten pretty expensive. Historically, well, historic is the Irish neighborhood, but then it became like a, you know, Latino sort of working class type of neighborhood, and then became gentrified quite, it's, I don't know, maybe in the 90s or something like that. So, yeah, I think that maybe those types of arguments are fine, but yeah, there are bad things that can happen from these types of things. And hotel bars, to-go cups, yeah, I don't know, maybe that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the context of a hotel, because it makes sense, people want to go up to their room, and but like, I don't know, like they've legalized it, my understanding is across all bars, which, you know, I don't know.
So you can,
when I was like younger and was, you know, going to bars actively, I think, you know, I don't know, I think, I don't know how good it is to be able to just take booze to leave when you're already at a place. I don't know.
In my younger days, and when I was working near Times Square, somebody told me about a pizza parlor near Bryant Park in which they would fill up a like kind of one of those big soda cups with beer, yeah, and you could walk around with it. And that's, it awesome, felt like a real like secret of New York.
Yeah, that's cool.
Type of moment, you know, where it was like, I was like, oh, I'm in the know about this thing. And it was cool. I just get a beer sometimes and walk around Bryant Park, and then
that's awesome.
Yeah, and then go home. All right. So the two things we're going to talk about today, right? The first of which is the royal family. This is something where I don't know that much about, but I did find the discourse around it to be quite fascinating. I don't really have any strong feelings about the royal family. I think it's stupid, you know, but like whatever. It's not going to bother me when at Wimbledon, whenever, you know, they kind of, they almost like curtsy to the royals, right?
Oh, yeah.
If they win. Like, I find that to be quite humiliating for the tennis players. And I always wish that somebody wouldn't do it, you know, because like,
yeah.
I personally probably, like, I'm sure I would if I was a tennis player. I just won Wimbledon. Like, I wouldn't want to be in the middle of like some huge controversy where I'm the first asshole who like doesn't do it. And then I have to answer questions about it for the rest of my life.
And I have snubbed the queen.
Yeah. I have like crazed people from like Arizona who love the Royals just sending me death threats all the time. Probably wouldn't be worth it. But yeah, I don't really have that much of an opinion about it. But, you know, we had this internet dust up, and I don't think it's just the internet. We have this thing where Kate Middleton, for anyone who's been living under a rock, here is the quickest explanation ever. Kate Middleton allegedly goes missing. People haven't seen her in public. There's all this speculation that happens about where is Kate? Where is Kate? Photo surfaces from that is sent out from the royal family. It has clearly been photoshopped. People say this is a photoshopped image. That leads to more intrigue, right? And then all sorts of weird explanations come out from the royal family, including one, I believe, that says that she's like working on a project or something like that. And then finally, the news comes out that Kate Middleton, very sadly, has cancer and will be undergoing chemotherapy. And this opens up this whole thing where people start saying, the internet is such garbage. Everyone is such garbage. We live in a garbage society. And then the other people being like, oh, yeah, I mean, that is really sad, you know, that that's true. And this really isn't our fault, you know. So, yeah, I don't know. Where do you land on all of this? Do you have any strong thoughts about the Royals?
I think beyond thinking it's like a ridiculous relic of a bygone era, I don't, you know, I'm not particularly interested in. I find the Americans who are fascinated by them bizarre. But, you know, and I, of course, feel very bad for Kate Middleton, as you would feel for, you know, anyone who's diagnosed with cancer. But I really didn't like there was an immediate reaction once this came out where some people were like, see, like, we shouldn't have been doing all these memes and jokes and conspiracizing, et cetera. And I just find that really enervating in a certain way, just insofar as these are not only public figures, but these are people who just enormous amounts of tax dollars go to and that have like all sorts of power and privileges and so on. And they are public figures paid for by the taxpayers who live in a palace. And like, I think it's, you know, perfectly reasonable for people to feel entitled to their to information about what's going on, to like their time in a certain way, not to be misled, certainly not to have obviously blatantly doctored photos peddled about as like, you know, evidence of whatever Kate Middleton is up to. I do think it's opened up this question about, you know, like right to privacy and so on. I mean, Pamela Paul in the New York Times had a piece on this, and she said, the American public has become so accustomed to unfettered access to public figures that we expect total self-exposure as a matter of course. Meanwhile, we meet their need for privacy, which belongs to every human, whether humdrum or celebrated, with a kind of rabid suspicion. The moment anyone in the public eye requests a desire to step away from the glare, we collectively make the worst possible scenario assumptions. And I guess I'm fine with that, to be honest. I don't know. I mean, I think, like I said, it is a fact of the job that, you know, you are under the glare of the spotlight. You get a lot of privileges and luxuries in exchange for that. And, you know, I don't know. I think I would feel differently. I think I would feel a little bit differently if this were a Hollywood person or like an actress or someone who's like famous for some other thing, because I do think like just because they're in the public eye in parts of their life doesn't mean they want to be in the public eye in all parts of their life. And they're not funded by the public, you know? But I do think there's something singular about the royals that made me deeply unsympathetic to the notion that we should feel bad about the sort of internet fracas this caused. I don't know. What do you think?
Do you think what Pamela Paul is saying is true, that the American public has become so accustomed to unfettered access to public figures that we expect total exposure, self-exposure as a matter of course? Like, I don't think that's true. I think that basically what has happened is that tabloid media and the sort of explosion of paparazzi in America that happened about 25 years ago has really died down, right?
Totally.
Like, we don't have, we do have TMZ still, but we don't have like Us Weekly and all these things taking photos of every single person. And then there are these celebrities like Beyonce, who is a huge celebrity, we don't really know anything about, right? We don't know a single thing except whatever Beyonce wants to curate for us, because Beyonce doesn't have to talk to the press because she has access to social media. She can just put out something on Instagram. That's true for most of our celebrities now. I feel like we're in a place where they have much more privacy than they had before. There are some exceptions, like, I don't know, like Justin Bieber or something like that. Mm-hmm. But those are people who almost seem to want to cultivate that type of attention. So I don't think that what she's saying is true. And I think that when people want a desire to step away from the glare, I don't think we collectively make the worst possible scenario assumptions. You know, we collectively generally don't even know who the person is. Like, there aren't people who are that famous anymore. Like, I'm trying to think about the people who would even do that. Part of the reason why there isn't the paparazzi is because most of the people who would have been, like, there aren't people that are that famous. There aren't Tom Cruise type figures where everybody knows who they are, right?
Totally.
Like, I mean, like, I could, 15 of the most famous TikTokers who have millions and millions of followers could like hop on this stream right now, and I would have no idea who they were. You know,
yep.
I don't know any musicians unless they're old.
Same.
Like, I would know Nas if he like came in, you know, like all these young rappers. I don't know who any of them are. That's not just because I'm old. It's because like everything has become atomized. Right.
Yeah, and so, I also don't know what they look like. Like, I listen to some new music, but I don't know what any of the fucking people look like. Like, I wouldn't be able to pick them. I just don't care.
Right. Yeah, it's not like Britney Spears, right? 25 yeah. years ago, or Christina Aguilera, or Eminem, or whatever, where like there is a celebrity based on them, based on television. Now we just live in a totally atomized thing. I think that very famous people can cultivate their own lives. So I don't know. I don't even know what Pamela Paul is talking about here. Like, I don't think that what she's saying is correct, but in the terms of the royals, she is correct. Right. And that's where it's weird. It's like, no, you don't have to make this about anything except the royals. I kind of agree with you. Honestly, like, Kate Middleton married into the royal family. Right. I'm sorry. Like, it sucks. I had cancer too, so don't get mad at me. Like, it's not me being insensitive to people who have cancer, but the scrutiny is, you know, something that was asked for. Same thing with Meghan Markle, right? I'm just like, I don't believe that you just fell in love with a nice boy from England and that you didn't want any of this, right?
Totally. You guys... you wouldn't even go on the first date if you didn't want it. You know? You like, fuck no, I don't want any of that.
You guys get so much money from Spotify, all these places. I'm talking about Meghan and Harry, yeah, you know, like all this ridiculous stuff. And everything is this like weird victim narrative, which I don't even understand, right? Like, it's like, I mean, I understand some of it. It's like people are, have, some people are quite racist to her. I agree, mm-hmm, totally. You know, but we had that conversation for years and we all supported Meghan Markle. And now it's like, sorry. there's only so much sympathy that I can possibly have. And I've really exhausted it. I actually saw Kate Middleton in person once.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was at a Nets game. It was a strange scene. It was a Nets game. It was a Nets game where Kyrie and LeBron, they were there with the Cavs. And I took my agent, Jim, because mm-hmm. Jim is from Cleveland. He's a huge Cavs fan. And as a present for being such a great agent for all these years, I took Jim to the Cavs game. And we went there and LeBron and Kyrie were wearing I Can't Breathe t-shirts. It became like kind of a, and there was big protests outside. It was during the Eric Garner protests. And Kate Middleton and Prince William were there and they didn't show up for the whole first half, showed up in the third quarter. And then LeBron just went crazy. And it was like one of these moments where you realize that he's so good that he can just say, oh, Kate Middleton's here.
Yeah, yeah.
Time to score 16 points in a row.
Yeah, that's crazy. Which
is, I don't know what the exact number is, but that's what it was like. You know, it was awesome to watch. And then after the game, I don't know what he did. There was something like he put his arm around her for a photo or something like that, and all these people went crazy. Like, you do not do that with the Duchess of York. All right, let's talk about the thing that let's talk about TikTok. Well, this is actually something I don't really know your general temperature on or how you feel about it. But, you know, I generally approach these questions. Now, for the listeners, what we were discussing is this bill and that was passed by the House, in which basically it would I don't know if it's going to pass the Senate. It still has to be signed by Biden, everything like that. But it would basically force ByteDance, which is the holding company of TikTok, to sell TikTok to a buyer that's not part of like a quote hostile country or whatever, right? And that if they can't do that within a very short period of time, the TikTok would effectively be banned in America. It seems as if TikTok is, or ByteDance is not going to sell TikTok, right? They're basically just going to give Washington the middle finger. And there's all sorts of speculation on why this is right. Some of it is like based on, oh, they just want to like force the most popular social media company to be in the hands of American investors. There's a lot of stuff about how like politicians are sort of profiting on this in a lot of ways and making hay by, you know, going after the one social media company that doesn't donate to them, right? Because social media companies are quite unpopular right now. So instead of basically making Mark Zuckerberg, you know, bite the bullet and, you know, be the focus of their ire when they do these little congressional hearings, that they can just do it about TikTok, right? And nobody cares because it's not an American company and they don't donate to American campaigns in the same way. So I approach this story mostly from a First Amendment perspective, and I just think that these things are, it's important to just keep about a lot of this stuff about as free as possible. But yeah, I was wondering about the way in which you approach these questions about social media regulation.
Yeah, I'm really torn. On the one hand, I think I share some of your like First Amendment politics and concerns. On the other hand, one of my kind of, and I'm a very anti-war variety of left person, but it often seems to me that the left has like no foreign policy at all, where their foreign policy is just like America sucks, and like, which it often does, that is true. But like, you know, I'm not sympathetic. There's a lot of people on the left that seem to be saying that this is just like Chinese panic, you know, anti-Chinese sentiment in the US, blah, blah, blah. And I, you know, they are a foreign government that is hostile. And I think it is not unreasonable to think that, you know, sending a bunch of data to a country that, you know, we have a slow simmering Cold War with is like not ideal. And I don't know how you balance that against the First Amendment stuff. I'm not overwhelmingly persuaded by the like, you know, another argument I hear from people on the left as well. How else are people going to see videos and stuff out of Gaza if it's not for TikTok? And I'm just like not persuaded by that because I just don't think that's true. Like, I think there are other places where that can get disseminated. And so I don't know. I really don't know how I feel about it, because on the one hand, I do think, like, you know, on the, you know, we're being really hypocritical because all of these other companies are also doing terrible things with Americans' data.
Including selling it to brokers who could just sell it to China.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so, like, I think there is some kind of double standard here. I think it's definitely part of what you point out, which is that, you know, TikTok is not donating to American politicians. And so it's a way of seeming like you're doing something with about the social media crisis without really doing anything. So I guess the case where I kind of come down is I just sort of shrug about the whole thing. I mean, I think the First Amendment stuff is important, but I just find the case against pretty unpersuasive. And often inarticulate, the like strongest stance. And so I don't know. I'm also not on TikTok, so I'm really not invested in this. And I, you know, the one thing I do think about the First Amendment thing is it's not as though there are not a whole bunch of other mechanisms through which other social media sites through which people can exercise their free speech rights or whatever. And I don't think TikTok is like depriving Americans of TikTok is like some fatal blow to free speech. But yeah, I don't know. I guess I greet it with a shrug, not being someone who sees or uses TikTok in any way.
Right. The First Amendment concerns are not so much about the expression part. It's about the receiving information part, right? Where there is a right to receive and choose between the types of information that you have as an American. And that's important because otherwise the government could just censor whatever it wants and you couldn't read half of the stuff that you want, right? And so that's part of the First Amendment. And that part is interesting to me, or at least is much more compelling to me than the idea that X creator won't be able to do Y content on the platform of their choice. That's less of a compelling free speech issue, although I still think, like, in the terms of norms and spirit, I would say that it was, you know, that that's also important, but I don't really care from a legal perspective. But yeah, I don't know. I'm so far in this free speech hole compared to most people in a way that I've started to realize is quite unpopular. But I, you know, I'm not going to change. But basically, I'm like kind of there. So we did this exercise and I wanted to share some of it with the listeners. And actually, let's do that in a second here. You sent me this story, and I'm going to read a little bit from it. And it's sort of about this larger question that I think that we should touch upon, which is that social media right now is quite unpopular, right? If you look at the way in which people respond to it, people really think that something needs to be done about it. So states, Utah, Florida, there's all these states that are trying to put at least age restrictions on it, right? That also comes with a tenant first Amendment problems. In fact, I would just say that both the laws are just going to be are flat out unconstitutional and most likely be overturned or not even make it out of, you know, whatever chamber it needs to make it out of to become the law. And the companies are actually like, there's almost no way that they can enforce these laws anyway, like from a functional standpoint. And so it might end up not even mattering. It might just be this thing. But I think this moment is happening because politicians realize that social media companies are unpopular. And when things are unpopular, politicians tend to attack them, right, to try and win points with the public so that they can get reelected or whatever, they can get more donor money. But that reflects a real shift in public sentiment towards these companies. And I think that the question that is out there and the one that I've been thinking about quite a bit, honestly, I've written 4 of the columns since this relaunch for the New Yorker, and almost all of them at least in some way about how do we get ourselves off the internet, right? Mm-hmm. How do we actually change our behavior so that we're not staring at phones all day, like kind of like downloading awful shit, right? Or even good shit or whatever, right? Like occasionally good shit. And so you sent me this article in The Atlantic, right? And it's by Deb Roy at the MIT Media Lab. And Deb Roy has come up with this idea, right? I wanted to read a little bit about it. And this is Deb Roy decided that all conversation is toxic, right? And that started a nonprofit to try and figure out what a better form of social media form would be. This involved going to different parts of the country. These people are at MIT. So like Deb and a bunch of friends, I think, or colleagues went out to different parts of the country that like are outside of the Cambridge bubble, which I imagine just talking about like rural white places. Yeah. And so from the piece, this is part of their methodology. We began experimenting with what we called a, quote, digital hearth, which had two functions. First, to record a small group conversation and then to play back excerpts from previous conversations at the command of the facilitator. This second feature was important. It let the facilitator bring in perspective difference from those in the group. We also built software to store speech recordings from the hearth, manage data privacy, and provide tools for finding patterns with, in and across conversations. Using our new tool, we led small facilitated group conversations in which people would speak and listen to one another about local issues with the digital hearth present to record the conversation and bring in voices from prior conversations. Facilitation experts. Okay, and then I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. Through all of this work, we came to a big realization about what our conversations had that many online conversations do not. Clear roles for key participants. We had conversation organizers, facilitators, curators, prompt designers, and analyzers to find and make sense of patterns of experience that emerge across conversations. Inviting individuals to play these roles in a social dialogue network, this is what they call instead of a social network, it's a social dialogue network, is an opportunity to participate in civic and democratic processes. Some online spaces have already moderators or admins, but we began to wonder what it would look like if we built a platform that resembled the conversations we had around our digital hearth. And that is the path our teams at MIT and Cortico, Cortico is the name of the nonprofit, are now on. What do you think about this? This big idea of like of trying to change social media and to, in some ways, reform it or to restart. Do you think that like that such a thing is possible?
I suppose I think it's like possible in some abstract sense. And, you know, there are moments where the internet can be good. There's this Twitter account I follow, which I might write about, so I'm not going to say which one, but it's like provides really interesting information and expertise about like wholesome topics. And it's just like great. And you know, that's what the internet was supposed to be. It was supposed to be a place where information could be freely disseminated. You can make connections with people who have interests similar to yours. I mean, the beginning of the internet, like a ton of it was just Grateful Dead stuff and people are trading like Dead tapes and shit. But yeah, I don't know. I think, so I think it's possible. And I think we see little glimmers of places on the internet and certain accounts or, you know, certain discourses where you can see a more positive vision. I guess I'm just really hostile to the endless like tech solutions to tech problems thing, you know, and that's kind of how I felt about this. I mean, I thought it was interesting, but you know, I think like the solution is not to just like tinker with the technology and do things slightly different. I mean, I think there is a good point, which is that like forums, in my experience, a decade or so ago, I used to be on a freshwater bass fishing forum, and those places that like have moderators and facilitators and like people have like, you get like little ranks and stuff, you know what I mean? Like there is a kind of social ecology that emerges that I think is like in general more wholesome and civil. But you know, I think it would be, I don't think it would be hard to design such a thing. I think it would be really hard to get people to want to do it. I mean, I'm not, you know, a psychologist, but I think and psychology studies don't replicate anyway, but assuming they did and psychologists know about this, I just, you know, it's not the kind of like why social media is addictive is because it has all these like gamified properties, you know, that are engineered to make us keep scrolling. And it would seem to me that like the addictiveness or the appeal of a social media thing would be kind of in direct proportion to its toxicity, you know? And so how you would get large groups of people to buy into a more wholesome sort of social dialogue network, I think is like an open question. And yeah, like I said, I don't know. I just, you know, when we say, well, look at this problem tech caused, let's like solve it with this like slightly different technological thing. I start to get suspicious. What did you
Yeah, think? It's like basically they're just talking about like a group chat, you know?
Yeah, totally.
It's like, I don't really actually understand how that differs from a group chat, except that people have jobs, which would kind of kill the point of the conversation, you know, if everyone had a job. I'm a little, I feel like there's no really such thing as a good internet forum. It took me a while to arrive at this place, you know, but because I also enjoyed using the internet, and I used it for a variety of reasons, and I was on different forums for different stupid things, right? Sports, I was on early days of like kind of sports analytics stuff. I would read all that stuff. I would, fantasy sports, whatever, right? And I found that I'm quite a toxic presence on all those forums, right? And that has sort of made me think about why that is. You know, part of it is because of my personality, but also because I think that like there's essentially like no way to reform these places where online communities are going to actually do anything except fight amongst each other and have a need for people to have jobs to regulate the fighting, right? And then if all the forum is the regulation of fighting, what the fuck is the point of the forum? And that's what everything is. I mean, every social network right now is basically just that, right? It's the whole drama around it, a whole meta narrative around it is just like, who is going to regulate the fighting, right? Like, that's like Twitter, everything, right? And it can happen at different scales and different iterations, but that's a basic question around it is who is going to regulate the fighting, like who is going to jump in and be the moderator, right? And the real answer is that nobody should ever want to be the moderator ever of any type of online forum. It is the worst job. And so this idea that like these people start a nonprofit, and I'm sure they got some sort of funding.
Oh yeah,
with MIT, right? They're now a nonprofit.
Millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah. I'm bet that this Deb Roy person, I don't know who Deb Roy is, but I imagine this Deb Roy person is going to write a book at some point, you know, that is going to be
the social dialogue network.
Yeah, exactly. Where they're going to go on every single TV show, they're going to go on like late night TV, and they're going to sit there and they're going to be like, the internet is toxic, but what if we just had conversations amongst each other, you know, and what if there were moderators and everything like that? It just seems like such bullshit to me. I feel like the thing that I always think about when I read stuff like that is I need to figure out a way to generate money for my stupid ideas, you know? And I think that the thing that the key to it is that you just have to load up on a whole bunch of bullshit about like things that people kind of vaguely like, have no idea how to fix. Come up with some silly solution that's like really easy to understand and can be discussed in words like democracy or democratization or something like that.
Or fascism, anti-fascism.
Yeah, although that one's too intense, you know, like this would never, like these, Deb Roy would never say that, right?
They yeah.
Would
just, yeah
you're Deb right. Roy would also would just talk about like, basically, you know, if we build layer upon this, then we can do this, and that somebody will give you like a few million dollars to go and make your dumb little talk box, you know, and no one will ask the question like, why don't you just pick up the phone and call your friends? Because that's basically what this is. But yeah, no, I don't know. I'm baffled by this. I'm basically a doomer on this stuff, though. I just think that there's no way to fix any of it.
Yeah, man, I think a lot of it is just like, we don't I forget the guy's name. There was like a sociologist who coined the term like third spaces, right? Like they're this idea that there's places that are neither like your work or your home, but that like are places in which you have some particular privileges that you get based on familiarity, like being a regular at a bar, for example. Right. Like the bar I used to go to in Queens, I'd go to the farmer's market and bring back fish and shit, and they'd let me store it in the bar fridge. And, you know, I think so many of these problems are downstream from the fact that like all of those places are gone and hollowed out and replaced by Starbucks that have no seating so that homeless people can't use them. And you know, I think that's like a huge part of the problem. And I think that's only been exacerbated by social media. I think that's only been exacerbated by things like dating apps and everything else, where people are just like very weird if you want to strike up just a conversation about what someone is reading at a coffee shop or whatever. And so, yeah, I don't know how you fix it. I think we will start to see more like technology-free zones, whether those are like bars and coffee shops with no laptops and no phones. I think that's very possible. But yeah, I don't know. I thought this was interesting, but just like really impractical. And it's just the kind of thing that like were you right? Like academics get grants to study, to arrive at an answer everyone already has, which is that like XYZ thing is bad or it's good. And it would be better if we did ABC thing. And they just like dress it up in a little bit of jargon. And then they get like a $5 million grant to like, you know, make some app that they will like unleash. That will be like a nonprofit app and it'll have like 200 users and then like be off of, you know, the Apple store in like 3 weeks.
And the whole point of it is so that like, one of the columnists at the Times or, you know, or I don't know, someone like me, you know, will pick it up. You'll put out a white paper. You have a university publicist contact the person and the person writes about it. Like somebody like this is like what Derek Thompson does a lot, right? At the Atlantic. Where it's like, oh, well, what about this idea? And you read it. And like, I don't have any problem with Derek, right? But, and so this is not directed at him. I mean, I've written a few of these too, mm-hmm. right? Where you kind of think about it and you're like, this is actually the dumbest idea I've ever, I cannot believe somebody actually did it, but it feels like the idea is just to sort of spread a little germ of a idea about something that people feel somewhat irritated about, right? And it's a way to scratch it. And the point is not to actually present the solution because the way that you've set out the solution is so stupid. Yeah, but the point of it is to, so that the person reading it, right, can sort of scratch the thing that irritates them and say, yes, that thing irritates me. The internet is bad.
It's like for dinner parties, you know, you just go to a dinner party and like, I read this thing that some neuroscientist said, if we do this thing, then things will be like this.
Yeah. Oh my God. Neuroscience is the one that drives me the craziest. I basically have concluded that like all of neuroscience is just junk science.
It's all bullshit.
And that the past 20 years of people trying to figure out things by looking at the places where the brain lights up has basically just been an exercise in confirming the narcissism and the selfishness of a, you know, sort of the upper middle class.
100%.
And that is basically, I don't know, these are the moments where I get almost religious about stuff where I'm like, it kind of is the absence of religion and God, right? Like that there's no meaning. And so basically people search for some sort of scientific or like psychological
brain flashing
idea that will allow them to feel like they're selfish behavior is somehow natural or like guided by science, right? And it's just weird. It just keeps happening over and over again. I read all this stuff. All of it is debunked, right? At all
it
times.
Never replicates.
Yeah. And then we end up with like little trends of brain science type of stuff that keep coming up and then going away, right? I've had this realization that my takes are getting older than I am. You know, like I'm like,
you're like aging, like in terms of your opinions are aging faster than you.
I'm 44, so I am going along the regular, I'm in time, right? In 1 year, I will be 45. But the acceleration curve in terms of the age of my takes is just sped up, right? And it's not that they've changed in terms of the core principles, but my crankiness is just turned all the way up right now. And I'm just like, I don't know. I think that it is maybe something happens when men reach a certain age where they become incurious about the world and that makes them kind of shut down. Maybe that might be what's happening right now. And if it is, then I will tell the listeners, I don't think that's a good thing, right? Yeah, I think people should remain curious, but I am not curious at all about the functions of the brain. I basically think that we just have this meat inside of our head and that most of what it does is just fire things based on like what it was programmed to do and that there are not that many interesting thoughts that are out there about anything.
I was listening to this thing today about large language models and like scaling them. And this one guy was like, yeah, but like large language models run right now, they run like 3 trillion transformations, whatever the fuck that means. But the brain runs 300 trillion synapses. So like we're so far below brain scale. It's like, what the fuck are you even talking about? These words don't mean anything. Like 300 trillion synapses versus 3 trillion transformations is just total garbage, man. I don't know.
Yeah. The brain is not that interesting. My brain especially is not that interesting to me. You know, I don't know. I don't find my, like what, there's not some mystery here, right? I think the listeners will know that. All right. So the last thing we're going to do here, one of the things about the online discourse thing that I feel is important is that I think that people need to speak in much plainer terms. I think that we need to stop talking about studies about how social media leads to depression amongst teens, or that social media, that we feel like we even need a study about something like that, right? I think we need to stop saying, is social media addictive, or are our phones addictive? And we just need to plainly state, very obviously, people's lives are worse because of their phones. Full stop. They stare at these glowing screens all day, right? Like half the day for a lot of people. For some people, more than half the day, right? Everything in there is programmed to addict you to it. People are much unhappier than they used to be because of these things, right? And in some ways, they're like, oh, it's because they're aware of the world or something like that. It's like, I'm not sure if being aware of the world is that important. But let me tell you, before phones existed, you know, we cared about shit like Tibet when I was a kid, right? Like, we were aware of the world. And so I think we should speak plainly like that, right? And so my general thought was like, okay, then you need an alternative, right? If you're an evangelist of getting people off of the internet, you can speak plainly. I think that's important. But if you just say, get off your phones, everybody, right? They're going to be like, I can't. And I totally understand that. I stare at my phone all day too. And it makes, you know, it's making me crazy. So, Tyler, I asked you as an assignment before this, you know, like, what would you, you now have a child yourself, right? Mm-hmm. You are a father. I'm sure that you do not want your child to be staring at their phone all day long. So what is a solution that people can do you think, to, like, what is one pathway? What is one, like, plan that you have?
Yeah, I mean, my kid's definitely only getting a flip phone until they're, like, 15 or 16. I don't even know when we'll get them a flip phone. I'm not persuaded by the idea that it's a safety concern. I had no phone until I was like, I don't know, 12 or 13 or something. I was fine. I was in much less unstructured and unsupervised environments than my kid will be. And I, you know, everything was okay.
But you got a cell phone when you were 12?
13, 12 or 13, I think.
Yeah. Was it like a smartphone?
No. It was just like a razor or something.
What year was this?
I was born in 1991, so I don't know, like early 2000s, firmly pre-smartphone, because like okay. It was like 5 years or something, or 4 years until there were smartphones.
Okay, got it. I was like, I thought you were like in your early 30s. Are you like 21?
No, go ahead. But yeah, so I mean, I think like in terms of my personal plan, I think that's like what my wife and I intend. But like at a broader scale, I just think they should be flat out banned for people under the age of 18. Like, I think, you know, you should not be able to have a smartphone with internet access. I think people should be able to have flip phones. But I mean, we regulate all sorts of things. That sounds totalitarian, but kids can't have cigarettes and they can't buy recreational marijuana legally and they can't, you know, drink. Like, we, you know, and they get around those things often, but nonetheless, we regulate them under the idea that they're like obviously and indisputably harmful. And so I think there's like a good case to be made for that. I would totally support that. I think a lot of people would too. I also feel strongly, and this isn't about kids.
A lot of people, so you're talking about like basically the same thing as alcohol, that like kids can't have cell phones, access.
Or
in the same way, like it's basically like you get one when we trust you to vote.
Yeah, or like maybe when you can have a driver's license, something like that.
Okay, that's the most intense version of this I've heard, but I like it. Okay, keep going.
Yeah, I mean, I just think like it's pretty clear they're really addictive. It's obvious from just having one that they're really addictive. You know, Martin Heidegger, the philosopher, had a line about addiction in one of his books, and he used the German word Sorge, which means care. But he says addiction is a reduction in our possibilities of care in the world. And he dressed it up in philosophical jargon. But what he meant is that if you're addicted to something, it means you can't choose certain things otherwise you could freely choose. Like if you can't get through a movie without going outside for a cigarette, like your options in the world are limited in some way. And that's how I think about you know, smartphones and social media. I think a lot of people would support banning them for children. I think a lot of people are like me, and I gather like you, where it's like, I would love to be more off my phone, but I just can't because they're really addictive. But also because the economy and like our jobs are so structured around them, you know? I mean, I would really love to see, it's effectively now de facto mandatory for you to have a smartphone in a lot of occupations because you need to have Slack. Like there's just like stuff you, you know, you need a smartphone for. And I would also love to see legislation that, you know, makes it mandatory that, you know, except for, I'm sure there are some occupations that would need to be an exception, but like for the most part, your jobs can be done without needing to have a smartphone. I mean, at Bates, we have, you know, two-factor authentication and they, there are a lot of crunchy environmental studies faculty. I'm actually maybe one of like two environmental studies professors that has a smartphone. The rest of them have like, you know, those like brick flip phones for environmental reasons. But they get these little fobs they carry around for like two-factor authentication where they have to like click a button when they need to authenticate themselves to get into their work email. But anyway, yeah, I support like heavy-handed government intervention. I mean, I think everyone is saying, I agree with your point about plain speaking. Everybody is saying that these are as addictive as like cigarettes and alcohol, that they literally cause brain damage and everything else. And it's like, well, there's other things like this and we regulate all of them. And like the objection I hear a lot is you hear all of these, like, I mean, you've mentioned the school shooting thing. And I know that's like a bugaboo of yours that I share, but like the, in the sense that, well, what happens if we don't have smartphones? Another one is that, well, there are gay kids in the middle of Iowa that like won't have access to blah, blah, blah. And I find that really unpersuasive, not because I don't care, but because I don't think smartphones are the only access to information. And more broadly, I think there's just like a question. There's people are harmed by any given policy. I think there's like a social good question. And I think, might there be some people in different, you know, circumstances in their life who might be ill-suited by not having access to a smartphone? I'm sure that's true. But on the whole, all sorts of people are way worse off, including gay teenagers and everyone else, by the presence of these things in our lives. And I'm really not persuaded by the objections that, you know, kids need to have access to
phones. Would you allow these kids to access the internet like on computers or laptops and stuff like that, or would it just be a pure internet full?
I think that would be harder to regulate, but you know, maybe, but certainly not phones. The portability of phones seems like such a problem. I mean, maybe I would even support like no internet outside of school. I don't even know that they need it in school, honestly. Like,
yeah, I don't think they need it.
I would absolutely support like the most intense regulation possible.
Well, if any of the listeners are have ever questioned Tyler's Marxist bona fides, I think he just laid them out. Full on repressive totalitarian state. Yeah.
No, I'm a total Stalinist about
telling everybody what to do. 100%. Okay, I find that kind of interesting. I think that, you know, basically, I share your skepticism about a lot of the arguments against it. I think that basically so when I tweeted about this, that I didn't think that kids should have phones in schools, in middle schools, right? That some people came by and said that, well, what about school shootings? And I was like, what a bizarre response. What about school shootings? And their argument was essentially like, if there's a school shooting, I want my kid to be able to say goodbye to me, which I thought was just a really grotesque way of thinking about the world. But B, I also thought was just like kind of narcissistic in a way, right? Like where like they are almost imagining this weepy scene where they're sharing a screenshot with NBC News or something like that. It's fucked up, man.
Yeah, you know, like that's horrifying.
Your child is not like a generator of viral content for you. And also, like, I don't know, man. Like, what do you want? What are they going to do with the phone? How is it going to increase their safety? Are they going to throw it at the fucking gunman?
Thought you were going to go in a direction of saying that these people were arguing that they needed to be able to call the police, but they're not even thinking
they're pro-socially.
It's like, how will I get my death texts?
Right. Which I just, like, I don't know. I don't want to go too hard against people because I actually think they're probably, like, there's something, like, it's such a weird way to think about the world that I actually feel sorry for them. So I'm not going to say something too mean about it, but that position is not uncommon, you know? And that's the part that actually bothers me. I asked around here in Berkeley a bit, but you know, my friends who have middle schoolers, and they say that when they go to school board meetings or they talk about it with PTA and stuff like that, because we also, like every town in America, have a problem with cell phone use. We have pretty good policies around it, but you know, it's still a problem. That argument comes up every single time, you know, and like that, I don't know if there was ever a reason to ban cell phones. It's that, you know, it's the fact that it melted your brain so much that you think that like, and the arguments in the classroom are non-controversial to me at all. Like, yeah, there's no argument. I was a teacher. right? Regulating what kids are doing when they have little distraction machines that they can text each other with, or they can tune out, everything like that is so much of a teacher's work these days, right? Figuring out what to do with the phones if they're in a school that doesn't have a strong policy, you know, enforcing it over and over again. It is so much work for them that they shouldn't have to do, right? They should be there. They should teach. The kids should listen. If the kid doesn't listen, it's fine, right? But they should be in an environment where they can listen. And if they have a phone in their hands, that is not an environment where they can listen to the lesson, right? And that, you know, I'm sorry, like, that's what school is for. If you don't think that's what school is for, if you think school is just a place where the kids go to get shot and they can text you weepy shit at the end, like, you're fucked up in the head, right?
Totally.
And I think the thing that is bothered me about that response so much was that, like, there was never, and this is why I think people hate teachers, it's just like, there's never consideration of the teacher in any of this or the role of education, right? It was just the worst case scenario that you learned through the news. And I do think that that means it is like a reflection of a fracture of society, right? Where you can't think of anything. If you could give them 20 reasons why phones are bad in school, and they probably wouldn't be able to argue against any of them, right? Mm-hmm. But in the end, they would just always feel like they held the trump card because they could imagine the worst possible scenario, right? And what their child would do. And I'm just like, it's like, I just don't have any patience for that, you know? Like, there are ways in which you have to have trade-offs to make a functioning society. And a lot of people don't really care about that at all, right? And I think part of it is because there's this narcissism that's been borne out by social media and everything like that. And that I wondered if these people actually would feel that way and express those opinions in person. Mm-hmm. It appears that many of them do, you know, because this is like a somewhat ubiquitous argument. My solution for all this is much simpler, which is, and it started out as a joke, but the more I think about it, the more I think it's maybe a good idea. I always think about ways to like scam wealthy people, right? It's like this, I don't know, I just do it because I find it generative, but it's also funny, you know? And so a few years ago when all the anti-woke stuff was happening here in the Bay Area and all these tech people were getting mad about the curriculum and everything, I had this thought that I would make an anti-woke school, right?
That's great.
And that I would charge an amazing amount of money for it, like $180,000 a year or something like that, right? But that we would basically have a fully class, basically what Barry Weiss did with the University of Texas at or whatever, University of Austin, Texas or something like that. But I would do it. She had not done that, by the way, you know, at the time I was thinking about this. So I'm not stealing Barry Weiss's idea. But I was just doing it as a joke because I thought it'd be funny to have, like, you know, a bunch of tech dudes who are really rich who don't want their kids to be infected with wokeness come to my school and pay me a bunch of money. You know, I just hand out worksheets.
And you're just like doing school from the 90s. You know, right? Like, yeah. It's just like, yeah.
We're gonna watch Romeo and Juliet today, the film, and I'm gonna hand out these worksheets and I'm just gonna sit back here and count your parents' money. So that was my idea. But then I started thinking that, you know, a lot of those same people, and I include myself here, that there are a lot of people who really are worried about their children's education because of phones, and mm-hmm. and that they would pay a lot of money to be in an environment where their kids had zero internet access all day long, right?
Totally.
Because, like, not, I'm not even talking about phones, right? Like, mm-hmm. They would not even have computers. So this would be some version of a Waldorf school without sort of the culty associations or whatever, right? I think somebody should start that school, right? Now, my original version, because of my brain, was like, oh, and they should charge like $200,000 a year because it would be funny. Because, like, at some point, some like rich people here in the Bay Area would basically say, I think tech is bad. I don't want my parents, or I don't want my kid to be part of it. And when you talk to parents over and over again, the thing they say is that they don't want their kids to have phones, right? But by the time their kid reaches 10, 11, 12 years old, all the other kids have phones, right? And then they are total social pariahs because of it, or they fear that the kids will become social pariahs because they can't participate in what everyone is doing all the time, right? Which mm-hmm. is fucking around on their phones with one another and bullying each other or whatever. If you could start a school where everyone opts into this, then you eliminate that social pressure, right? And then that's where my brain goes, like, well, how much would people pay for this thing. And I would just, for me, I do not believe in private school, so I don't think I would do this school. But if I did believe in private school, I would pay an enormous amount of money like proportion to my salary for my child to be in a place for at least 8 hours a day where she had zero access to the internet, you know? And outside of like whatever reasonable thing might exist, like to be away from phones, I think would be so valuable. Anyway, that's my idea. There's two versions of it. The first is like kind of a free, you know, I don't know what type of school it would have to be. Either that or I'd run for school board and force my ideas upon. Like there would be some sort of version where
go full Stalin.
Like the kids would be writing in those blue notebooks and shit, you know, like there would be no internet at all. But I think that's where it has to start, right? Because you have to eliminate the social aspect of it. It has to be about kids because people feel much more emotionally attached for good reason to outcomes for children. And then you have to basically show the results at some point. I think the results would be quite good. You know, like I think the kids would just be different in a very palpable way that I would find to be a good way. I don't know. What do you think about my idea?
No, I love that, man. I mean, I think often I'm somebody with like a lot of hobbies, and I think I often wonder if it's because I, you know, grew up before like the internet was a big thing. I mean, you know, we had internet, but it was like slow and dial up and, you know, AOL and whatever. You know, I have no data to support this, but I have to imagine like there's just been a decline in like hobbies for children and kids and like doing stuff outside of like sports, basically. I think you're right. But I think there's like the social ecology problem you're rightly mentioning, which is that people are like, oh, yeah, I would love my kid not to have a phone, but then he's going to be like harassed or bullied, which always like ignores the fact that they're getting bullied on their phones, you know. But setting that aside, yeah, I totally agree. I think it would need to start at like a school level. There needs to be a kind of, and I think we might see it, that is my like crank hypothesis, a kind of counterculture around this. You know, like I think there needs to be young people that think like it's cool to not have cell phones and to be like off the grid and to not be on the internet, not to be on social media. And we've had previous moments where people have like withdrawn, you know, or dropped out, as they called it in the 60s, you know? Yeah, I don't know. So I think we need some combination of legislation, spaces like schools, like you're mentioning, where it's just like the whole peer cohort is like operating from this similar technology free space. And then just some kind of like change in cultural values to turn away from some of this stuff. I mean, whether that happens, I don't know. But I do think like there's just going to be particularly, I think about a lot is like what happens when AI image generation is better. And if it gets to a place where it's actually hard to tell photos apart from, you know, AI generated photos apart from reality. I mean, maybe we'll never get there. I don't know. And there's all sorts of other like social problems that would stem from that. But like just on a less serious scale, I do think there's going to be a thing where people are going to be like, why am I going to be on Instagram when I don't even know if this is real? Like if these photos of this person on their beach vacation and, you know, with their six pack is like real or not, I don't care. Like they could be fake, you know? This is the thing I think a lot about with phishing because, you know, phishing on Instagram is like really awful in the sense that there's just like, you know, I fish at night and you'll see these like camera flashes or fucking people with GoPros that are trying to get photos while they're out on some rock fishing so they can put a live stream up on Instagram, you know? And I think like once it's at a place where people are like, I don't know if that fish is real, that could be AI generated. I think, you know, some of that, I hope, this is my hope. Like, this is the thing I think about a lot. Like my hope is that once, you know, it actually becomes very difficult to tell, like just the interest in image based like social media will decrease. But you know, who knows? Maybe that won't happen at all. Maybe people don't care. Like maybe people don't care about reality and they'll just be like, oh,
it's, you process the world through fishing Instagram in the same way that I process it Instagram.
There's a great book by Lorraine Dastin and I'm forgetting her co-author. It's called Objectivity. It's really good. And it's a history of the idea of objectivity. And she points out that there was like originally when photographs first appeared, like we now think of photography as like the gold standard for objectivity, right? Like I saw a photo or video of it, but she points out when they first appeared, it was the exact opposite, particularly in like science books and stuff. Whereas like now in biology textbooks or a zoology textbook, say you'd have like photographs of animals or organs or whatever. When photography first appeared, there was this sense that actually photography was non-objective because it was giving you a single example of a thing rather than like drawing the ideal type. So like, yeah, a single photo of a deer is less objective than like a drawing of like the idealized average deer or whatever. And my rambling point is that who knows, like maybe we'll get to a place where people convince themselves that AI generated images are like more real than the like, real images that they get at something more profound. Who knows? But my crank hope is that one day as AI generated images become ubiquitous, people will stop caring about Instagram and so on.
Okay, that's a good take. I enjoyed it. I was there along the, I don't know if I agree. I don't even know if I, where to agree or disagree, but I feel like it was, I feel like that was a journey. You know, good. Yeah, I don't know. I think about it in terms of, is it important for individuals then to make sacrifices as in ways that are going to be somewhat, maybe even inspiring to other people, right? Like, should I get off Twitter and just say I'm done? You know, I don't want to do this anymore. And what are the reasons why I don't? Now, the reasons why I don't are all very stupid, right? Like they're me fooling myself. It's like, oh, well, I need to like be able to announce the podcast. And like, it really doesn't change based on Twitter at all. You know, it's like, well, I need to be able to tell people when my next column comes out. It's like, nobody cares. And secondly, if they do care, they're going to find it anyway. And also the people who do care are 72 years old and they're going to read it either way, right? Like all that is real right now. If I was younger and I was hustling a Substack for the majority of my money, maybe that'd be fine. But Elon Musk has solved that problem by making Substack links basically shadow banned for Twitter anyway. Yeah, I don't know. My reasoning is bad on it. I just stay on it because it's addictive. And and I think I've reached that point where I'm just like, oh, in the same way that you're saying, I think the only solution is some sort of countercultural thing where people just opt out of it. Like a straight edge movement, for example, right? Mm-hmm. I don't understand why there's not a no online straight edge movement amongst the youth. I wish there was, right? Like if my kid came home and was like, had a bunch of X's, you know, drawn on the back of her hands, like the straight edge kids did when I was young, I would be thrilled. I actually cannot think of something that would make me happier. You know, I'd be like, oh, that's cool. And then I'd meet her friends. They're like, your friends are a little annoying and self-righteous, but I'm glad that none of you are. I'm glad that none of you are on the internet right now.
Self-righteous in a
I think that's what it'll take. I mean, I don't know. I keep praying for it, but who knows? I think that basically what I've come to the conclusion of is that like I sort of support cultish Luddism, you know, and that, you know, maybe I should start living it a little bit more. On that note, I think we're done.
Right on.
Thank you for listening to the show on the internet. Maybe we should just change this to like get off the internet is our main topic. You can support the show for $5.
You can send them CDs.
Or you can mail us $5 a month. Exactly. And if you'd like to email us, it is it's time to say goodbye pod at gmail.com. Tyler, until next week, we will talk.
See you then, man.
All right. Cool.